Hello and welcome to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. This week on the show, general elections put the Netherlands back on a centrist course, and Ireland elects a left-wing independent candidate as president. Also on the show, twice in one week, why European leaders are so keen to visit Turkey's Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Ankara.
Many of the European defense systems are in some way compatible with the Turkish military hardware. At the same time, Turkey is one of the emerging player in the security market.
Those stories and more coming up on the programme.
Voor het eerst in de geschiedenis.
Our top story this week is, of course, the nail-biting finish in the Dutch general elections, called following the collapse of the governing right-wing coalition after anti-immigration firebrand Geert Wilders and his populist PVV party quit in a row over immigration and asylum policy back in June. In a major surprise to analysts and pollsters, the 38-year-old leader of the Liberal D66 party, Rob Jetta, managed to triple his party's share of the vote and, as Inside Europe went to studio on Thursday morning with almost all the votes counted, both D66 and Wilders PVV were tied with both parties projected to get 26 seats each. Because of the near universal reluctance of other parties to risk another coalition with the volatile Wilders, this puts Jetta in pole position to head up the next government, which is likely to be a centrist coalition, although of exactly which political flavour remains to be seen. To talk me through all that has just happened, I'm joined on the line from Amsterdam by a presumably very tired reporter, Fernand van Tetz. Fernand, if you were a Dutch headline writer right now, what's the line that you'd be going with?
So the line everyone went with was, this is a win for Rob Jetta, this is a win for the centre, the centre is back. Because, of course, even if Wilders still becomes the biggest today, he lost 11 seats and Jetta went from 9 to 26. So he wins in a big way, almost tripling his number of seats. So I think the takeaway is you can win on a positive message. You can win on a positive platform. It can be done. And there was a real need among Dutch voters to have this alternative for the hard right coalition that's been in place over the past couple of years and who didn't manage to get a lot done. And so I think that's the main takeaway, that it can be done and the centre can win.
Okay. And Jetta himself is very clearly drawing lessons, not just for the Netherlands, but also for the wider world from this victory, saying that he's shown, or his party has shown, that it is possible to beat populist and extreme right movements. If that is the case, Fernand, what was the playbook?
So the playbook was to basically focus on, okay, we do have these problems, but we can tackle them. And of course, what helped them is that the 11 months that the last government was in power, they didn't manage to achieve anything. So asylum, which was this topic which drove Geert Wilders to election victory a couple of years ago, he had a minister of asylum and she didn't manage to get any laws through parliament. So that was really in his favor, that they could say, look, we are going to get things done. And their slogan, you know, it is possible, is literally what the slogan was. Three words, like, yes, we can, of Obama. That was their main message, like, we will be able to govern, we'll actually be able to get stuff done. And in this era of negativity, we should be positive, we should have this positive campaign. They also reclaimed nationalism. So there were a lot of Dutch flags at their campaign events. Also last night when the results came in, tons of Dutch flags waving. That was a symbol that really was kind of shunned by the middle and owned by the right. So retaking that and also using really simple language. For example, just last week, Jette said, you know, quite explicitly, kind of, most people hate the asylum system, using a kind of slang word, which is quite explicit, but it is very simple. And so he's also taking kind of this very simple narrative and explaining things in simple ways to appeal to the same kind of voter, but with a different message.
Right. And that shift in framing and that shift in public opinion, which has resulted in the results that we see this morning, that has really happened in a very, very short space of time, so much so that D66 itself seemed rather surprised.
Absolutely. I mean, I was at the event last night. It wasn't such a big venue. It was 800 people. They hadn't clearly not prepared for the huge amount of international press that would be there on the night. Dutch campaigns are kind of strange in that they're very short, usually about 3 weeks. And actually, they're only really the last 2 weeks is what it's all about. This is when there's a lot of TV debates. The leaders of the parties are in all the talk shows and on radio shows. And it's actually a very media-driven campaign, usually. Obviously, they're also on social media a lot now, but it's very short and a lot can change. So if you peak too early, which, for example, is the case of the Christian Democrats who were campaigning on this campaign of decency, new leadership, they look to be heading for the prime minister's post just 3 weeks ago. But they seem to have peaked actually too early. And then the momentum was taken over by D66. So two centrist parties both vying for that disillusioned voter who's looking to get things done. Dutch campaigns are just very strange like that. And yeah, Wilders actually created this opportunity for Jette, because a couple of weeks ago he suspended campaigning because of a threat to his life, he said. You'll remember there was this threat against the Belgian prime minister and he was caught up in that and used that as an excuse to not show up for debates. And actually that gave Jette an opportunity, which he took and really maximized on and introduced himself to the public as this positive person with a, you know, kind of really like Mark Rutte, the prime minister of the Netherlands that led four different cabinets. He kind of tries to emulate him, you know, kind of sleeves rolled up, always a smile plastered on. And that's an image that, you know, Dutch voters know, recognize and stuck with them. And so he really kind of used that momentum very well. And also kind of took advantage of the fact that Wilders, I don't know, he's just been a bit lackluster this campaign. He cancelled a lot of interviews, including with kind of right-wing big newspapers like the Telegraaf. He didn't go to all the debates. He's always a bit picky about media, but the last time around, he was really trying to put his message out there. He was really available. And this time, yeah, he didn't show up. And when he didn't really have the old fighting spirit, except for maybe in the last debate. So also the contrast between these two choices was very stark, kind of this old man who seemed a bit grouchy at times and this young person glowing with this big smile. Just visually also it was a very strong contrast.
Talking about the key personalities of the campaign, I think we have to talk about Frans Timmermans, so that sort of veteran big beast of centre-left Dutch politics, had a terrible night and is stepping down.
Yes, so his party was at 25, lost 5 seats, went down to 20. And this after a merger, actually, of the Green Left and Labour Party, which was meant to put this party on top. Timmermans actually in better form than 2 years ago, much more comfortable, much more owning the left, taking really the left space in the political spectrum, speaking out on that and saying, we want to become the biggest. Last time around, he was more angling also for people in the centre. He really kind of stepped up for the left this time and was hoping to reap rewards from that. But what we see is a lot of people who did recognize that left-wing voice then still opted for Jette, opted for someone a bit more centrist. So a loss for them. And yeah, he, within an hour after those results, he said he was stepping down and leaving it to a new generation. But he's happy that he's made this merger work. And we'll have to see next time round if a new leader can make this combination work and draw people back towards the left. And I mean, this result, I must say, has to show that even if you've been around for a long time, you can still suddenly win, because Jette was the leader of D66 also 2 years ago. And then his party only got 9 seats. So it can be very, very volatile, Dutch politics. So we'll never know what happens next time round.
Very volatile and famously fractured. I think you have a system where just 0.67% of the vote translates into a seat, which results in this sort of landscape where you have lots and lots of different parties, a sort of a patchwork of which will be needed for a coalition. Based on where we are this morning, Thursday morning, Fernand, what are the sort of possible likely scenarios going forwards?
There are two options, both which go through the centre. So one is D66 and the Christian Democrats, then with the left, and then the liberals of the VVD would have to join that. That would give them a really solid block of 87 votes, I think. But the liberals have campaigned on the fact that they will never, ever join a coalition with the left. That was one of their selling points. If you do not want the left to win, vote for us. So it is very unlikely that they will do that. They have been talking about a centrist right coalition, which in reality will have a bit of a radical right slant, because that would require the Christian Democrats, D66, the liberals of the VVD, but also Ja 21, which is this new right-wing party, which has taken a lot of PVV voters as well, which is sort of PVV in better packaging, if I have to say it. They have a lot of the same viewpoints on immigration. They also basically want to close the borders, but they kind of are a bit more eloquent about it. And I think also this result, you know, we shouldn't forget, basically the far right bloc in the Netherlands does now hold 41 seats. It's just more fractured. So the only two options right now are the right or the left. And I have to say, judging, unless the liberals are willing to change their tune after Timmermans' resignation, the only viable option that I can see right now would be this centrist right coalition. But then it's a question, do D66 want that? I mean, they are quite progressive. They do not agree at all with Jan and Twintel. They've really said that they've, you know, they're the anti-Wilders. So would that not really undermine their credibility if they would go into a coalition with the party that has a lot of the same views? But of course, we'll have to see. It depends also if the Christian Democrats and D66 hold on to each other, then they'll form such a large bloc that they'll be able to influence whether it goes left or right. But we'll have to see. I mean, Dutch coalitions, as you know, take a long time to form. Last time around, it took 7.5 months. The time before that, it almost took a year. So people are hoping that there'll be a new cabinet before Christmas, but let's see. I'm quite skeptical, if I'm honest.
Amsterdam-based reporter Fernand van Tetz there, hopefully off to get some sleep. Ireland also went to the polls this week, albeit in a lower stakes election, since it was the post of Irish president that was up for grabs, and in the Irish system, that role is mostly ceremonial. Nevertheless, the public vote is often taken as a litmus test of public opinion, and Ireland has just elected a left-wing independent candidate who stood on a platform of climate action, housing rights, and the idea of building a new republic based around ideas of inclusivity and diversity. Earlier this week, I spoke to Owen O'Malley, Associate Professor in Political Science at Dublin City University, and asked him to explain this idea of a new republic.
Yeah, so this idea of a new republic, a lot of it emanates from the 1916 rising, and in that there was a proclamation of a new republic. It has no legal basis, but it's a sort of foundational document for Irish people and Irish politicians, and in it emphasises that we'll cherish all the children equally. And so for many, it's interpreted as a sort of left-wing document. Now, the revolutionaries who wrote that were, in fact, actually quite conservative Catholics. She and a lot on the left tend to kind of hold that document quite dearly to them. So it's not clear exactly what that would mean. But the other aspect of Ireland's sense of itself is that it's a neutral country. Now, neutrality was more or less something that was decided upon in 1939 because it made sense for us not to get involved in the Second World War. But it has grown to be something that is almost like a kind of state or national dogma where Ireland has to be neutral. And we've seen over the last number of years other previously neutral countries ditching that neutrality because of the threat of Russia. I think because of Ireland's relative geographic isolation, we don't feel that need to do that. And she has tapped into something there where the Irish government is trying to remove something called the triple lock. So Irish troops can only be sent abroad if it has a UN mandate and if it is passed by the parliament and it has government approval. And so the Irish government is trying to remove that. And this has led to this big kind of questioning about neutrality. And Catherine Connolly probably is one of those people who would be inclined to excuse Russia and said things like, you know, Russia only did this because NATO was a threat, and tends to be less willing to support aid for Ukraine and Ukrainians. And so that is one of the kind of more controversial aspects of her pitch and of her past, and one that possibly will cause conflict with the government in the future.
Just to clarify there, excuse Russia, as very much sort of looking at her perception of what she sees as NATO expansionism having been a provocation. She's not condoning the invasion of Ukraine.
No,
she's very clearly said that Ukraine has a right to defend itself. So we've got this sort of awkward positioning in relation to European allies on foreign policy vis-a-vis Russia. We've got very clear positioning on Israel and Palestine, a very condemnatory approach towards Israel, very, very supportive of Palestine. And we've also got a combative approach towards the USA. These are all positions that will be watched closely, coming from someone who will have a figurehead position for Ireland. How do you think that this could impact foreign relations, foreign policy going forward?
It'll be awkward because she is very vocal on those three issues. Now, on Israel, she's probably more or less in the mainstream in that most Irish public opinion is very pro-Palestinian. She has been very condemnatory of Donald Trump. And given Ireland's, you know, close cultural and economic ties with the US, that might cause some concern in government buildings in Dublin. And so there will be concern that she will kind of speak too much on these issues. And what could happen is if she does try and kind of speak a lot, she might find her passport is taken off her, because there's very little that an Irish government can do to censure a president, particularly a popular one, but they can stop them from going abroad. They, you know, they have to get permission to go abroad. So that might be one way in which, if there is a conflict, that might be one way we see the conflict played out.
Eoin O'Malley is Associate Professor in Political Science at Dublin City University. Eoin also pointed out, by the way, that the unusually high number of spoilt ballots, around 13%, reflects a sizable constituency of voters who did not see themselves represented by the available options on the ballot. So, in other words, despite Catherine Connolly's convincing win, Irish public opinion remains divided as elsewhere in Europe. Turkey now, which this week welcomed not one, but two major European leaders to its capital. First, the UK's Keir Starmer, then Germany's Friedrich Merz. For more than a decade, Turkey's backsliding on democracy has kept Europe at arm's length. But the growing threat from Russia and Turkey's potential role in Europe's defence seem to be ushering in a new era of cooperation, ironically, at the same time that President Erdogan's crackdown on opposition reaches a new peak. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
The Turkish presidential band greeted Friedrich Merz as President Recep Tayyip Erdogan rolled out the red carpet for the German Chancellor. It was a busy week for the band. A few days earlier, it serenaded the British Prime Minister, Keir Starmer. Starmer's visit was to sign off on a multi-billion euro sale of Eurofighters, produced by a four-country consortium, including Germany. The sale has been long coveted by Ankara, as it desperately seeks to replace its decades-old jets. It was only possible thanks to Chancellor Merz, who lifted Berlin's veto on the sale. A veto which had been cast in part because of Turkey's deteriorating human rights record. Soli Özel of the International Relations Department at Istanbul's Kadarhas University claims a Eurofighter sale underscores a shift in European priorities amid the growing Russian threat.
Whether many people like it or not is going to have to be part of European security. Given Russia's proclivities and stuff. And by the way, since the European Union is no longer the European Union of our grandmothers, and so the issues of human rights, rule of law and all that no longer count for anything, that's a relation that is cleared of its thorns, if you will.
In a break from past protocols, neither Merz nor Starmer met with opposition leaders during their Ankara visit. The British Prime Minister's visit came just a day after espionage charges linked to British intelligence were filed against Istanbul's jailed opposition mayor, Ekrem İmamoğlu. Yet Starmer did not once comment on the case. Instead, both the German and British leaders' Ankara talks focused mainly on security cooperation. Federico Donelli of Trieste University says that with Turkey home to NATO's second largest army and a rapidly growing defence sector, there is potential for collaboration as Europe rearms to counter the Russian menace.
Many of the European defense systems are in some way compatible with the Turkish military hardware. At the same time, Turkey is one of the emerging players in the security market.
An advert by Turkey's Baykar company extolling the virtues of its military drones, claiming their successful use in conflicts extending from Ukraine to the Caucasus to Africa. It's niche fields of expertise, like drones, that Turkey's rapidly growing arms sector is focusing on, and they are key to Europe's rearmament. Political analyst Sezin Öner of Turkey's Politikyol News Portal says Ankara is now seeking to join the EU's €150 billion arms procurement program called SAFE.
Being in SAFE will be a big win for Erdogan because any kind of removal of remaining sanctions or limitations or prejudices against Turkey strengthening in the defense sector and, of course, modernizing its air fleet, he can project it as a win for the domestic audiences.
However, EU members, Greece and the Greek Cypriot government are threatening to veto Turkey's participation in SAFE, citing ongoing territorial disputes, in particular over the divided island of Cyprus. Erdogan is waging a diplomatic campaign to secure international recognition of the Turkish Cypriot administration, which is currently recognized only by Ankara, and is ending any hope of the island's reunification. But this month's shock landslide victory of the Turkish Cypriot opposition might change that. The opposition won on a platform of resuming reunification talks. Former Turkish ambassador Selim Kunalp believes this may provide an opportunity for Erdogan to adjust his stance on Cyprus, thus persuading the Greeks to drop their opposition to Turkish participation in the SAFE arms procurement program.
Now that you've got these election results, you've got a new administration in northern Cyprus, a president who says that he wants to come back, you know, to the negotiations. Well, that opens a small window out of which Mr. Erdogan's administration might climb down.
But it's not going to be easy. Greek Cypriots' unease is likely to rise in correlation with the waxing strength of Turkey's military. Meanwhile, domestically, Erdogan's crackdown on opposition, civil society, and the media continues. Dorian Jones, DW, Istanbul.
Just a reminder that if you'd like to comment on that or any other piece that you've heard in the programme, then our address for feedback is insideeurope@dw.com. You're listening to Inside Europe. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. Welcome back to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. We have 30 minutes of Euro culture coming up for you now, ranging from high culture to dance culture. Appropriately, in this election week, our story comes to us from the Netherlands, where the world's largest electronic music summit has just taken place. The Amsterdam Dance Event, or ADE, is an intoxicating mix of panels, networking events, demo drops, workshops, and of course, parties, totaling some 1,200 events in over 300 locations. In other words, it is wild. How do I know that? Well, because Inside Europe's producer, Laura Kabelka, told me so.
Every year in October, just as the Dutch weather turns grim, Amsterdam Dance Event, or ADE, literally lights up the city. What started 30 years ago as a small meeting place for DJs and industry insiders has grown into a five-day marathon of events, this year with nearly 3,500 artists. I'm biking through the city center right now, and it's always full of tourists here, but on top of the regular visitors, you now also have loads of music lovers and industry professionals coming just for ADE. Many of them are wearing the black and yellow ADE badge, so it's easy to spot them. ADE is a mix of events and people. There are different tickets, a very pricey one for the whole conference, a cheaper one for the lab program where you can do workshops on things like how to mix records or test the latest gear. And you can get single tickets for events. It's hard to choose and know what to expect. Even a bakery can turn into a dance floor here.
ADE is a celebration of nightlife, of freedom, of liberation.
It seems to me bring a lot of heavy players of the industry, of the music industry, and just electronic music and beyond together.
Yeah, it's my first time at Amsterdam Dance Event, and that's amazing because you meet a lot of people, publisher, manager, labels, booker.
It puts Netherlands on the map, Amsterdam on the map, yeah.
It has a special place for me in a heart because I've been there from the start, you know.
I think it's amazing how people from all over the world come to the city for the week and just let loose.
It's my third time at ADE. I was in the lab as an emerging artist. I was interested in workshops and more practical things. Now I'm interested in both of it, especially in networking, collaborations, etc.
Many ADE goers come for the world-famous acts like this year's Black Coffee or Amelie Lenz, who fill huge venues. Most tickets come with quite the price tag, which many complain about.
Because often ADE events are ticketed, they're very expensive, and not everyone can access those events, or maybe they don't want to go to events that are organized by a very commercial organization as well.
I think ADE is just a way for clubs to charge double for the exact same parties that they put on every week. And it's just capitalism at work.
But ADE does offer several free events each year. And there are also smaller, more experimental events like this modular techno improvisation. Politics is in the mix too. There's ADE Green, an environmental sustainability track at the conference.
Can you imagine how much people in Ukraine need to feel the same? Just went out and forget just to dance?
Or there was a panel on how to organize events in war-torn Ukraine, where I learned that many venues reserve a quota of free entries for service members, or they donate proceeds to the army.
Where is the shelter? Where is the shelter for all of the participation of the party? It's hard.
What is our responsibility as leaders in the music industry, as artists? What can we do to...
And this was a panel on how to deal with unethical partners in the music industry.
My name is Floor Beuming. I work for Amnesty International here in the Netherlands. And I am a researcher focusing mainly on the Gulf states and Israel-Palestine. There's been a lot of talk and uproar around, especially a large private equity firm, KKR, that bought several music festivals. And this firm having investments that links it to human rights violations in Palestine. I think it's good that the music industry is thinking about its human rights responsibilities.
Then there was Striptopia, a show that challenges stigma by celebrating the art of pole dancing, stripping, and queerness.
It's a safe space where we're platforming and supporting sex workers, and that's really what's important, is that it's safe and it's inclusive and it's open.
Biking from venue to venue across Amsterdam, I can't help but compare the scene to Berlin, where everyone is speaking of Clubsterben, or the death of clubs. This is also happening here. The life cycle or permit of a club in the Netherlands is usually just a few years. That's what Mirik Milan told me. He was Amsterdam's first night mayor, which is an independent advisor representing the city's nightlife.
I was the night mayor of Amsterdam in 2012 and 2018. Gentrification is a big challenge. It's almost impossible for venues to gain enough money to actually buy a building themselves. It's always this cycle. Okay, a neighborhood becomes more interesting. There's like a hospitality offering. There's cultural offering. That's why people want to live there. But as soon as the housing is set up, then the cultural establishments, they need to leave. So they're the victims of their own success.
Outside of ADE, nightlife is increasingly being pushed to the city's outskirts, and public transport doesn't really run all night.
There's all kinds of conversations happening now. How can we make the going back and forth to these places, how can we make it more safe for women or any vulnerable groups?
Many told me that ADE is very commercial, which is not how rave culture started. Inflation, gentrification, and Gen Z's more restrained consumption patterns are changing night culture. But with a record-breaking 600,000 participants, many of them young and aspiring artists, electronic music still seems to be very much in demand. And the Dutch dance floor is often a space of experimentation and diversity, a dynamic that appears to endure whatever the wider political reality. Laura Kabelke, DW, Amsterdam.
From the world's largest electronic music summit, we move now to the world's largest award in classical music. For the first time ever, the prestigious Birgit Nilsson Award has been given not to an individual artist or orchestra, but to an entire festival, the Festival d'Aix-en-Provence in France. It's a bold decision which reflects the jury's determination to assert the continuing relevance of opera against a backdrop of social and political change. Tellingly, the work which they singled out for particular praise was Innocence, a musical exploration of the emotional aftermath of a school shooting which premiered at Aix in 2021. Arts journalist Brendan O'Shea was at the awards ceremony in the Swedish capital, Stockholm, and sent us this report.
This year's laureate symbolises what the prize now celebrates, the collective pursuit of excellence and the courage to explore what opera can be today.
This evening, tradition and history join hands with the strength and momentum of the present. This evening, the Birgit Nilsson Prize consecrates a unique and collective artistic endeavor, that of the festival's artistic and technical teams, whose enthusiasm and perseverance have endured for 77 years.
Sophie Jeanne-Sans, mayor of Aix-en-Provence, paints a vivid image: tradition and history joining hands with the present. Birgit Nilsson, one of the greatest sopranos of the 20th century, was celebrated for her powerful voice, dramatic insight, and unwavering dedication. The prize that bears her name seeks to honour that same spirit, excellence, courage, and a lasting impact on the art form. Yet, like the festival, the Birgit Nielsen Prize is changing. Often awarded to individuals, this year it goes, for the first time, to an opera festival. It's a striking move, one that recognises opera not as the work of a single star performer, but as a collective act of creation, shaped by singers, directors, designers, and the communities that keep it alive. And the timing seems deliberate. Opera, like every cultural institution, is having to move with the times to stay relevant. The Birgit Nielsen Prize seems to be repositioning itself in the same spirit. While the festival Aix-en-Provence received the 2025 award for its artistic vision and commitment to new opera, the jury singled out the 2021 world premiere of Innocence by Kaya Sarayao with a libretto by Sophie Oxanson as a striking example of the possibilities of where opera can go, exploring new forms, confronting contemporary realities and expanding the art form's reach. Innocence confronts one of the darkest realities of our age, a school shooting and the silence that follows. It unfolds a decade later at a wedding celebration where the trauma of the past suddenly resurfaces. Through its layered timeframes and haunting music, Innocence forces us to look directly at how tragedy shapes memory, family and forgiveness. By honouring both a festival and a work like Innocence, the Birgit Nielsen Prize acknowledges something fundamental, that opera's future lies in its ability to face the present, not escape it.
Excellence in all its aspects. Also something that Birgit was very specific about, you know, being truthful to music. It's not about the person, it's about the music. We want to support the next generation singers and musicians and the way that this year's prize recipient does it. In Aix, we have this wonderful academy which has meant so much to so many young talents.
The Birgit Nielsen Foundation's president, Susanna Ryden's words, capture the prize's spirit, artistic truth, integrity, and nurturing future generations. And in Aix, that spirit thrives through performance, education, mentoring, and creative exchange. Sir George Benjamin, composer and conductor, understands this culture of creative freedom perhaps better than anyone else. His opera, Written on Skin, was born in Aix, where the festival's artistic advisor gave him complete liberty to stage the work. That freedom mattered. Inspired by a 13th century legend, Written on Skin tells a brutal story of desire, jealousy, and the power of art to reveal truth. But Benjamin and his librettist, Martin Krimp, tore it away from tradition. Their score is taut and luminous. Their storytelling fractured across time and their staging refuses the safety of distance. The result is both ancient and utterly modern. An opera that looks beauty and violence straight in the eye. At Aix, that risk was not just tolerated, it was celebrated.
Bernard in Aix, he didn't ask for anything. He gave us complete freedom. And one of us, Martin or me, said, "Is there anything you would like to ask us?" And he thought for 30 seconds And then he said, yes, there is one thing. And he made a gesture, which was that, please set the opera here. And what do you mean? Here in the land of Occitania in Provence. So that little gesture was incredibly important. But in terms of its impact personally on me as a composer, no, that was the first night in Aix. Changed my life, yeah.
It's that trust, that invitation to create, that made Aix a home for today's most adventurous opera. Equally important is funding, which Sir George notes is severely lacking in his own country, the UK.
We do have an operatic world in Great Britain. We have had also very gifted operatic composers and wonderful singers and wonderful directors and conductors. And we have several good opera houses and one absolutely world-class opera house in Covent Garden. Mm. But it's true that we don't have the 32 opera houses that they have in France or the 87 or something that they have in Germany. And it's not as integrated as deeply into our culture. And also in terms of funding, I do find the situation in my own country almost a disgrace. And I find that very sad.
Sir George's words underscore why this year's award feels so apt. France's commitment to opera has allowed institutions like Aix to flourish and serve as models for artistic excellence, public engagement and cultural integration. Sophie Oxanson, Finnish novelist and librettist of Innocence, created a work that speaks directly to our present moment and beyond it. By taking a painful, controversial, contemporary topic and transforming it into something timeless, Innocence demonstrates the unique lens that art can offer on our social and political realities. It challenges us, moves us, and asks questions that stay with us long after the music stops. Indeed, at its best, it can make us see the world differently.
How can we have the future if we don't have new operas? Then it's not very relevant. Otherwise, it just doesn't make sense.
But opera, it really takes time to get it on stage. And you don't know what the world is going to look like. So in that way, that limits certain options that you really have to trust that, okay, if I'm going to write about this, then this has to be relevant in 10 years. And, well, author's perspective is also like transgenerational, because I'm not writing only for the audience of today. But I do hope that my stories will travel to the next generation and the generation after.
Aix Festival President Paul Hamelon reflects on the premiere of Innocence and the impact it had on the audience.
I still remember that vividly. And at the premiere, the audience kept silence for several minutes. That doesn't happen that often. It was a rare and powerful moment. And it showed how contemporary music can address urgent societal issues with depth and sensitivity.
That silence became a collective recognition, affirming what Birgit Nielsen herself believed, that live music can stop time. Foundation's president, Susanna Ryden.
It's about the live experience. There is nothing that can match that. Disconnect with everything around us and just be there being, just flushed by a strong musical performance. We shall need to use this focus to highlight the importance of music in society, the need for us to have the arts as a natural ingredient in people's lives.
In a divided world, the arts can give us moments of shared transcendence and be a mirror to our society. Aix proves that is still possible, but only if we embrace new voices, bold perspectives, and of course, fund them. Without that, the music and the courage it inspires might not survive. For DW, this is Brendan O'Shea in Stockholm, Sweden.
A mini manifesto for the political necessity of arts funding there. You heard it here on Inside Europe. Exciting week in the world of children's literature too, with the announcement that the prestigious Booker Prize Foundation is to launch a major new literary award, the Children's Booker Prize, offering £50,000 for the best fiction writer for readers aged 8 to 12. What better time then for us to bring you a tribute to some of the most enduring contributions to European children's literature, the Moomins. The bubbly-faced, hippo-like creatures and their friends are celebrating their 80th birthday this year. And in honour of this milestone, reporter Heidi Fullerlove set out on the trail of the Moomins and their reclusive, nature-loving author, Tove Jansson. And if you're Moomin hunting, there is only one place to start. Tampere, in the Moomins' native Finland, home to the world's only Moomin Museum.
Finns, who are intensely proud of their iconic gender-fluid Moomin trolls, will tell you that with their deep thirst to understand the world, their everyone's welcome ethos, their love of nature and ability to embrace quiet moments, thoughtful reflection and seasonal shifts, Moomins embody many of the values encompassed in Finland's happy country status. Created by Tove Jansson, herself the child of two artists, Moomin Valley is a place where everyone is welcome, no matter how odd or different. Characters like the free-spirited Snufkin and the fierce little Mai live by their own rules, whilst, just like Tove's own mother, Moomin Mama is the family's calm and nurturing central figure. Moomins are such a central part of Finnish life. There are Moomin-themed spaces all over the country, including a Moomin-themed children's hospital in Helsinki. At the world's only Moomin Museum, guide Sonja explains why the lovable trolls are still popular.
It was always on TV when I was a kid, and now I have a kid and we watch the Moomins. If you go somewhere, you say, oh, you are such a Moomin Papa or whatever character. They know what it means.
But beyond the whimsy, there's another level to these comic strip characters that Jansson drew from 1954 to 1959 for well-known newspaper The London Evening News. These are symbolised in characters like the invisible child who turned invisible because of emotional neglect, or the Groke, a ghostly figure who can't be approached because she freezes everything she touches, and the Lady of the Cold, who symbolises nature's indifference and the harsh reality of Finland's dark, endless winters. At the world's only Moomin Museum in Tampere, the southern Finnish region known as the Land of a Thousand Lakes, guide Marie tells me why author Tove Jansson first created her hippo-like troll character in the late 1930s.
She needed a place to escape the horrors of the war, and this Moomin troll character was the it worked kind of as a signature of Tove. Yeah, and then Tove wanted to create a place where there is no war.
During World War II, Finland was caught between Nazi Germany and the Communist Soviet Union, and Tove, who was 25 when the war started, worked for a satirical magazine, Garm, where she openly criticised both Hitler and Stalin in her political cartoons. Faced with air raids, rationing and the death of close friends, in her diary, Tove wrote about disillusion and fear and her longing for beauty and peace. The war is like a veil of lead. You drag it with you wherever you go, she said. This dread and sense of hopelessness are seen in her first Moomin tome, The Moomins and the Great Flood, which is a dark story about catastrophe that ends with the discovery of a safe and peaceful space in Moomin Valley.
There are scary things and frightening things in the Moomin world, but usually they are like natural catastrophes. And in the end there's happy ending.
Janssen's Trolls shot to fame after she was commissioned to write a regular comic strip for the UK newspaper in 1954. Her personal life, at a time when being gay was illegal, was more complicated, however.
Tove Jansson fell in love with Vivica Bandler, and it was the first time when Tove fell in love with a female, and she understood something big has come now into my life. If there wasn't for queer or rainbow people, we wouldn't have our museum. Mm. Yeah.
He didn't really know whether he went down to the beach for her sake or just in the hope that the...
Leaving Tampere in the glorious, endless sunlight of midsummer, which Tove saw as a liminal time when the boundaries blurred between real and magical, I drove through lush countryside dotted with red-roofed, wood-framed farmhouses and grazing cows to Moomin World in Naantali. It's only 9 in the morning, but already this 4-hectare park, set on its own island near Turku, bustles with life.
And here you can see our blueberry blue Moomin house, and there are like 5 storage, and they live, they have own, like Moomin Mama and Papa has their bedroom, and Snork Maiden, and Moomin Troll. And then there is a pass, nature pass, around the island, where you can meet, for example, the croak, or you can meet the Hattifatteners.
Anna from Helsinki Tours tells me that the wordless, emotionless white figures that can't be touched are said to mirror Janssen's difficult relationship with her father, the man who inspired Moomin Papa and who decided to become silent and mysterious, just like the Hattifatteners.
She had lots of problems with her father because he was very conservative. He had been fighting on the white side in the Civil War, also pro-Nazis, Tove thought.
Like most Finns, Janssen, who spent months at a time on Kloverun, her island in the Pelindji Archipelago, believed nature was the best cure for her troubles.
We have to be close to nature. Still today, Finland is covered by 70% by forests, and we have the 180,000 lakes.
80 years since they were first created, Tove Janssen's Moomins are as popular as ever in the country in which she was born. Perhaps because the themes of loneliness and belonging, freedom and loss, love of nature and resilience are just as relevant, if not more so, in today's uneasy world. Heidi Fullerlove, Finland.
I actually find myself thinking of the Moomins quite a lot these days, with the daylight getting shorter and the weather getting colder. I think of them snugly tucked up in bed, hibernating until spring. Since I am not a Moomin, however, I can say with reasonable confidence that I will be back next week with another edition of Inside Europe. In the meantime, a quick reminder of our feedback address, insideeurope@dw.com. This programme was produced by Laura Kabelka and me, Kate Laycock. Our sound engineer was Jan Winkelmann, assisted by Navina Boot and Lucy Krub. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.